How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. Belonging. It's something we all seek, yet for many, it's never quite felt secure, fixed, or even fully found. In a world shaped by migration, identity, and shifting cultures, belonging isn't always about where you come from. Sometimes it's about how you learn to exist in the spaces in between. Today I'm joined by educator and writer Birgitte Carr, whose reflections on belonging first found me through her Substack, The Unlearning Project. Her life has been guided by a deep love of learning, reading, culture, and travel. Today, she joins us from Thailand, where she works as a teacher, navigating yet another cultural landscape. Hello, Birgitte. I'm so grateful that you agreed to have this conversation with me. What did your parents model to you in childhood that you've embraced in your life?
Well, that's a great question. An immediate answer is reading. I grew up in a house that was full of books. We didn't have a lot of money. We had obviously come to Australia in sort of circumstances that were less than what I'd describe as well off. And so we didn't have huge amounts of toys. We didn't have like a lot of things, but there were always books. And I think that was something that mum and dad both prioritised. I remember reading with them at bedtime. And that wasn't just mum or dad. It was a combination of both of them. So story time was something they both actively participated in. They also modelled reading. So there were newspapers, there were magazine subscriptions. Mum was part of a book club. Dad always loved a good Wilbur Smith because I think it took him back to his African roots. So the two of them, they practice being readers themselves. And I think that makes an enormous difference to, so many different aspects of who you become as an older person.
It really does. You took me back to my childhood, actually, where my mum was a reader. She used to read till 3 o'clock in the morning. And my dad always had a paper. Every day they had a newspaper. So we had encyclopedias because that was how we learnt, facts and information in those days. But yeah, it's true. And you think about how that connects you to not just information, but stories. So what types of stories influenced you as a child?
You're gonna laugh at this one. It was Time magazine that really sort of started to capture my imagination. One of the earliest memories that I have is reading about the Tiananmen Square massacre. And that's because there was the latest edition of Time had rolled in. I mean, at that time, you also got cool freebies, like you'd get a camera sent in the mail or whatever. So we always used to look forward to seeing what mum and dad were gonna open along with the magazine. And then, they'd read it and they'd pop it in the living room and gradually I would go and I'd have a look. And even if maybe the text was a little bit too much for me at the time, like I remember Tiananmen happened when I was maybe eight or nine years old. So I'm not sure that I actually took away like the deep cutting events, but I definitely could see the photographs. And I remember seeing Tank Man on the front cover of that magazine and just thinking the world is... It's a big place. There's a lot of stuff that I don't understand about it. And I was captured from that moment on. I think politics was something which was in my sphere. I think travel was something that I immediately wanted to do post that. But I wanted to know more. I had a lot of questions and curiosity about what was going on.
Love that. It's such an important part. It's a crucial role for children to have that established in their life. How do you think that curiosity served you through influencing your perspective beyond your family borders?
Once I started to become aware of the fact that there were these really big events that I maybe didn't know in countries that I didn't know much about, it changed what I would look at in the library. I know that I loved geography when I was younger, so I used to love looking at atlases and finding out where places were, and reading about the social geography, which is something I think that we've got to be really purposeful with our children to actually like to give them those encounter moments. I actually recently taught a group of grade two students how to use atlases, and they were absolutely hooked. They loved looking at them. I had so many different questions about the different kinds of maps that were produced. And, you know, that was really a link to me in my childhood, because it helped me to begin looking for ways to answer my own questions, maybe beyond what adults were sharing with me. Because I know mum and dad definitely didn't they didn't explain to me in great depth what had happened in China. I think I probably found out about that much later. But they pointed me in different directions, and they helped me to become a natural inquirer, I think, which, you know, again, links how did they model, you know, ways of being in the world that sort of have influenced me now. I think I've always had questions and always pursued answers to those questions, and that started really early.
You mentioned that you came to Australia with not a lot. So where did you come from, and how did the Australian culture at the time shape your sense of belonging?
Yeah, again, another good question. We came from Southern Africa. So I was born in Rhodesia, in the then colony of Southern Rhodesia. A week later, it became Zimbabwe. So there had been a pretty bitter guerrilla war fought in that country, and my father fought on the British troop side. So inevitably, after a couple of years, things sort of started turning a little bit sour, and we realised we needed to leave. So we went to South Africa to wait for refugee visas to be processed, and then got on a plane about 18 months later for Australia. So I landed in Melbourne as a little girl who really, I mean, I didn't have a lot of experience of life. I only had an experience of what was my family context. And that was very Southern African, which even years later, I kind of sometimes struggle to put my finger on exactly what made it different. All I know is that we were different. I didn't sound the same as everybody. So that meant when I landed at my very Australian, sort of very upper class Australian school, I was, you know, I looked like everybody else, but I didn't sound like everybody else. And so immediately I started gravitating towards other children who sounded or looked different as well. So I remember having German friends, one of my best friends, still one of my best friends to this day, is half Thai, half Australian. Kind of how I ended up in Thailand many years later. You know, I had an Egyptian friend, we had English friends. So I sort of immediately gravitated towards people who also kind of didn't quite belong. And I think that's probably shaped my entire understanding of what being Australian is, in a way. It's like it's that belonging, but not quite.
Of course, you're living and working in that country currently, travelling between Australia and Thailand. What have you discovered living within that Thai culture?
It's really interesting that you ask, actually, because I'm just in the process of writing my next blog, which is actually just taking a pause from what I've been focusing on in Australia and actually really noticing how I shift shapes when I come back to Bangkok. So I have a way of being in Thailand that is actually very different to my personality in Australia. And I'm not sure whether it was sort of stepping out of Thailand for 4 months, because it's the longest I haven't been in the country since I moved here sort of 14 years ago. And coming back, I sort of noticed it immediately, even the sound of my voice will drop. The way I approach questions drops, the degree to which I am like deferential or polite improves. I have to listen more because I don't speak the language fluently. You know, it's also not incumbent upon me as a foreigner to participate in life here. Like, I think the Thais appreciate it when we do, but it's also really not appreciated when we do as well. So it's learning to live in these strange sort of like sideline grey areas. And I think anybody who has lived in two countries, so like spends time in two countries or even three countries, probably understands that quite well. You take on a different personality, essentially. So yeah, it's been really interesting, particularly as Bangkok is I arrived back on an election weekend. Normally I would have a lot to say about politics, but when I'm in Thailand, out of necessity and also the law, I don't talk about politics because it's actually just not the done thing here. You have to be very careful about what you say, and that's something we don't have to think about quite as much in Australia.
Well, that actually takes me to a point. I read another one of your articles on Substack, and you'd attended the Australia Day rally in Melbourne, but you aren't normally someone who marches. Why did you choose that activity on Australia Day?
Yeah, it's part out of curiosity, I think. I have always sort of just stepped back and like kind of taken a little bit of an overview of what gets reported about these sort of marches. And I think after watching what I kind of think of is a very one-sided sort of reporting narrative coming out of the mainstream media these days, I actually just kind of wanted to go and see what the atmosphere was like and see, you know, what it actually felt like to be not just at the Aboriginal March, but also at the March for Australia. They were both happening in a very sort of small area of Melbourne at the same time. I have to say kudos to the police for actually orchestrating that march because they did a beautiful job of actually keeping them separate for the most part. You know, and largely both marches were peaceful, which was great. I know they haven't been sort of leading up to this, and I was a little bit curious to see whether that would be maintained, like whether there would be any problems or whether peace would actually be maintained. But also I just kind of wanted to experience, like I hear a lot of comments about, you know, these people who are angry and these people who turn up and it's all about anger and I don't know, just like a feeling of discontent. And I have to say the March for Australia definitely didn't feel comfortable to me. However, I also don't, like I didn't experience any of the narrative of like this being an overtly racist group of like rebel rousers. You know, I think there are a lot of people who were standing there who had a lot of different signs. They were there for a lot of different reasons. And I think having that perspective gives me balance when it comes to writing about some of these issues. I don't want to look at people and paint them with one brush. I don't think that that's how people behave. And I'm sure, you know, there are a lot of things that I would disagree with going on at that particular march, but not everything probably. So then I went over to the other march and, I mean, the crowd was infinitely bigger. I really do question the estimates that have been given about how many people were there. I've been in protests in Bangkok, particularly during the military coups. I remember being here in 2014 when there were 300, 400,000 people standing around, and that was like the smallest of the protests along the main street of Bangkok. I was in the midst of a 1.5 million people protest, and it was definitely not that big, but I would put it at probably around about 90 to 100,000 people there. It was a big protest. It was peaceful. It was humbling. It was really, really painful listening to stories from, you know, First Peoples in Victoria about losing parents in custody in the last 10 years. I'm like this, I don't know why, but actually hearing that out of somebody's mouth really, it took that out of abstract for me. It made it really real. It took the theory of what it is that I'm learning and made that into something that I could touch and that I could feel. And I could put myself in her shoes. You know, my mum passed a few years ago and you never get over that pain. So to have your mother, you know, incarcerated and die in custody just really because she was, you know, a black woman and not a white fella, as she said, it was hard. And so, yeah, it really sort of shifted my perspective on what these protests are about and why people turn up to them, what they hope to achieve. I think it was a show of solidarity. And as much as it could be, it was celebratory. People were celebrating people that they had lost in a really somber and really serious way. But yeah, as an Australian, I think I'm questioning Australia Day more and more. I wonder whether the 26th of January is worth pitching a tent over. Like, I just don't think it's doing the work that we think it's doing. So yeah, that was kind of why I did that.
You made a really interesting point, though, in that very well written, very well articulated and researched, I might say, because there was information in there that I hadn't been privy to earlier, including the fact that Australia is the only country that actually celebrates its National Day on the day that Captain Cook came to Botany Bay. This was before colonization. So the history that you've shared in there, I mean, why do you think it matters that people educate themselves on that history, and what difference would it make to the date?
Yeah, look, I think that it's a complicated question, and I'm not going to profess to have the ultimate answer, although recently I saw a meme on one of the social sites that was like, I suggest May 8th. Pronounced mate, and I was like, that would just be an absolutely perfect day. I'm like, who can get into that as an Australian? So I mean, look, I think this is actually kind of part of the recipe, though. I think we really need to approach this with more of a sense of openness and of humor as much as we can, while being respectful to the fact that, you know, you're right, this, we are the only country on earth that celebrates our national day on what is deemed a genocide for its first peoples. And I think when people put that framing into perspective, they're instantly starting to feel a little bit uncomfortable about it now. And I've noticed that there are a lot of people who are choosing not to celebrate. They're choosing to, you know, do something on the long weekend, but it's not as nationalistic as maybe we would, like the newspapers would have us believe. And I think in large part, this is because this is kind of a way of us orienting our place, ourselves in this place. Like, we don't all belong to this dominant settler narrative that has been part of our education system for as long as I can remember. And I think there's, you know, there's been books written about the history wars in Australia, about how disengaged children feel about learning Australian history, because it is all just, it's like 200 years of cookie cutter colonial, you know, dialogue, which is just sort of repackaged and wheeled out year in, year out, to the point where children are like, I don't want to learn about James Cook anymore. And yet, there's this other history which should be being taught parallel to, and not just in chunks, not just sort of dumped into our curriculum for a unit or here or there. But if we were teaching what was happening simultaneously for our first peoples, I think suddenly history becomes quite living. The drama is actually there. Australian history is shocking. It is horrifying. You know, there are causes for celebration in there, but we also have some reckoning that we need to deal with. And I think the problem is that as long as this debate keeps going, we can't sit and feel proud about our country. And doesn't everybody want to be able to feel proud of Australia? Like, despite what I write about, I actually am incredibly proud to come from this country. I think that we've got insanely interesting history. I think we've got beautiful geography. I think we have one of the oldest living cultures in the world who, you know, we should be elevating and feeling proud of and embracing. And I think as long as we continue to celebrate a dominant white narrative on a day which causes them harm, they sit outside it. And, you know, that's what's important about this. Our children need to know that their histories will be honoured in this country. And at the moment, a lot of them aren't. So if you're a migrant child, your histories aren't really honoured. I don't think we've begun to figure out how to do that. If you're a First Nations child, your histories are not being honoured. If you're a child who sits within any other culture on the outside of what is mainstream, your history is not honoured. And so, yeah, it's about unsettling a dominant narrative, and that always makes people uncomfortable.
We're all migrants, though, aren't we, in this country, unless we are First Nations? I mean, I've always looked at it as though my heritage doesn't belong here. My grandparents came from Scotland and England and Germany. That's where my family heritage sits. So, and my husband's, and, you know, a lot of the people I know. So I think if we really all looked at the fact we've all come here from somewhere else because we're not Indigenous to this country, it might make us actually take on a different perspective. I mean, you said something in there about pride, how proud you feel to have lived in this country and be part of this country. And I think that's what we've stripped from Indigenous peoples, is their pride.
Yeah.
Because their culture and the way they connect to land has been stripped from them, which is part of their very being. How do you see the total culture of Australia, and what is it that makes you so proud?
Ooh, big question. I think for me, Australia, I mean, we have to sometimes sit and acknowledge the fact that we're probably one of the most, if not the most you know, successful settler colony on the planet. We have people in our country from almost every other country on Earth, and somehow we still manage, despite all of this, you know, these culture wars and this sort of like media screaming at us that we are divided, I actually think we are more united than we are divided. We have more in common than we like share differences. I think one thing that we can all agree on, particularly those of us who do have migrant histories and recent migrant histories, I might say, versus those who are, you know, fifth, sixth generation Australian, is that a lot of us had to fight really hard to get to Australia. And so I feel sometimes like the migrant cultures that we bring with us actually really, you know, they diversify what we have to offer as a nation. They make our dialogues stronger if we can stop and we can listen to one another. And actually, I feel like with the proper education, and this is absolutely key, those migrant cultures could be responsible for actually bringing things for First Peoples into a better state of being. Because, you know, who knows better than what it is like to sit on the sidelines of something than somebody who wasn't born here? From my perspective, I literally sit and I look at First Peoples and I just think they are in many ways the same as my family are. They've been dislocated. They've been moved from where they came from. They've lost culture. They've lost connection to land. They've lost connection to family. Some of them have lost their languages completely, as have a lot of migrant children tend to go through that process of losing the dominant language. And those things aren't small, and yet they unify an enormous percentage of us in Australia. So when I think about what Australia could be, what the bigger conversation here probably needs to be, it's how do we make sure that everybody in this country matters and feels seen? Not for, you know, some outdated idea of what being Australian is, but for all of those little things, for the little contributions that we all bring that make our country great. And I think if we really take the time just to sort of sit back and actually listen to what's being said to us by First Nations people, particularly through processes like the treaty in Victoria. I don't know if anyone's going to sit down and read the 400 odd pages of the Europe, you know, Truth Justice report. It's beautiful. It is absolutely humbling. Most of it are first account stories from First Peoples who share what their experience of Indigeneity is like in this country. And they're not asking us to give them back the lab. They're not asking us to give them back the systems. They're not asking us to replace what we know with something that they would prefer. They're asking us to like walk hand in hand with them in a journey towards something better. And for me, that has to be what the promise of Australia is going forward. It's how do we all matter? And how do we make sure that everybody matters?
Wow. I just got goosebumps listening to you. And what a legacy, though, for us to leave, if it could be that powerful. I'm voting Berg for Prime Minister. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
I've really enjoyed this. You're absolutely glorious. And I think next time we're going to focus on what you've come to understand through education and working with children. I know we talked about children and body autonomy and moulding, not modelling. So that's another chat for another day. Thank you. Thank you so much.
No, you're very welcome. I look forward to it.
Well, there's something deeply moving about Birgitta's story, not just in where she's been, but in how she continues to navigate the spaces between cultures, expectations, and self-identity. Belonging, as we've heard today, isn't always a destination. Sometimes it's something we learn to create for ourselves. For Birgitta and for many people, especially those shaped by migration, displacement or cultural transition, the idea of home can be fluid, evolving and even complex. Maybe that's what invites us all to reflect on how we welcome others or how we create spaces of inclusion. And how we nurture a sense of belonging, not just for ourselves, but for the children watching and learning from us. I love this conversation. If it's something that you enjoyed as well, I encourage you to explore Birgitta's writing on Substack, The Unlearning Project, where she shares thoughtful reflections on identity, culture, and what it means to truly belong. You'll find all those links in the show notes. including ways to connect, reflect, and continue the conversation with me. I hope you join me next time for another explorative conversation with a new guest. Wherever you are in the world, let's be the change we want to see. Together, we can make a huge difference.